Hi, this is Chris Atwood of The Alternative. Tonight we're joined with Dave Wakeling from The English Beat here in America, The Beat to those of you in the UK. Dave, welcome to the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We have lots to talk about. You've got a great career in this alternative ska genre of music. Take us back to 1978. What led to the founding of The English Beat, given everything that was going on in England at the time?
Well, I think it was a mixture of exhilaration and desperation. Politically, things looked as though it could be very tense and things could get very nasty. People seemed to be getting used to living on the knife edge of a nuclear decision. There was great austerity and joblessness and great foment in the streets and a fair amount of scapegoating. And all the jobs had disappeared, but it was the immigrants' fault for taking them anyway. A lot of things, to be honest, that echo again today. Almost as though it's a pair of bookends. And I wonder whether it's not just the perfect time for my record because it's the other bookend, it's the other slipper, it's the other shoe dropping.
And that shoe being your new album, Here We Go, which is being released, is it June 15th?
June 15th, yep, Here We Go, love.
We'll get to that in a few minutes. What were some of the influences for you? I mean, here you are, this, you know, English youth, if you will, coming out of Birmingham, England, with this incredible ska sound, led to the English Beat sound, and how'd that come together?
It was an interesting combination of things. Oddly enough, ska was used at the soccer stadiums in England in the late 60s and early 70s to keep the football fans who were of the kind of skinhead working class persuasion. Mm-hmm. It was to keep them calm, to try and stop them from getting on the field and fighting, which was what they liked to do, or charge the other team, the best scarves, and start fighting. So they used to play this music, ska and bluebeat music, for them. And a couple of the teams where we were from in the Midlands even used it as their entrance onto the field, the Liquidator, which was the inspiration for the Staple Singers, I'll Take You There. I know what the ladies. So that was my very first hearing of it. Then you'd hear it at street parties down the bottom of the road. And then records started to become easier to find. The Trojan, Tighten Up volumes 1 through 4. And then I think that kind of led into reggae. Started to hear in the early 70s.
So you have this music that's being played at the football or the soccer stadiums to keep the hooligans from fighting one another. And
yeah.
Almost to appease that, to me, is just absolutely fascinating. And then you bring in the whole reggae sound. It's 1980. You come out with three great albums from 1980 and 1983. I Just Can't Stop What Happened and Special Beat Service. Take us through some of the songwriting for that and the process. And is there a song or two that really sort of stand out for you from those three really great albums?
A different blend and balance of songwritings. Some of them were poems that I'd written before I was ever in a group and then had put them to basic tunes with an acoustic guitar. And then Andy Cox, the guitarist, had helped me spread them out a bit. You know, it wasn't just the same three chords round and round. And then others were songs that David Steele had written a hypnotic, fabulous bass line, and I just wrote poetry over and over and over till it fitted and it was right. So there were all sorts of different techniques. Probably one of the most satisfying was in the third album, the drummer Everett said to me, "Oh, you know, I wish I could write a song. I can't write a song. I'm just a drummer, aren't I?" And I said, "But you say lots of things that could be lyrics in songs." So it's just that people think when they've got to write a song, they have to do it with a kind of formality, a songwriting style or something. I said, "You should just use what you say conversationally and put it in interesting orders to attract people's attention." You know, we went on tour and I got 8 little notebooks, which I still have, and numbered them with a big number on the front, passed them around, and then every few days, 3 days, something like that, so people wouldn't lose it. We swapped, and number one gave his book to number two and all the way around, and number 8 gave their book to number one. And we did that for about 8 weeks, and the books were nearly filled up, and I collected them all at the end of the tour. And I kind of used them as a raw beat directory, thinking about like Brian Gysin's cut-up techniques that William Burroughs and beat poets and David Bowie had also been fascinated by. The power of words when kind of disassociated from each other and put in other interesting combinations. Every time that I needed some more lyrics or I needed inspiration for the songs that were coming for the third Beat record, I would go cruising through these notebooks, and Everett ended up writing the vast majority of the second verse of Soul Salvation. Somebody who said he could never write a song,
right,
I thought was quite a good start, really, because a lot of people say that's their favourite English Beat song. So that was a pretty good start. And I just edited his words together from different things that he'd said during the eight books, just to show him, really, that he could write a song.
Absolutely.
Do it right, do it now, here, there, everywhere, shouting out, I'm as mad as hell. He pushes his legs against the bed and feels the power rushing to his head. Says, I could conquer, I could win. And then I added, now that dying only means you're not in next week's programme, which was kind of our view of the passion of American television. Dying only means you're not in next week's programme. It's not serious. You know. Bang! Oh dear, never mind. All right, you'll be in another series.
So Soul Salvation came out of a bunch of books that you guys were just using to write lyrics, or thoughts that came to mind as you're going from city to city on tour.
Well, that verse did, certainly. Yeah. The actual idea from the song came from a book that I'd enjoyed at school called Two Cheers for Democracy by E.M. Forster.
On our Facebook page, and thank you for taking a look at it, we posed a question for the listener. Jane asked, what's the story behind Save It For Later?
Well, it's funny because it's a song with no story, really. It's a song about not knowing, about walking into the dark from childhood to adulthood. And that awful time where you look like you've grown up and people are definitely starting to talk to you as
right.
though you are a grown. But as a boy, not quite yet a man, and particularly dealing with women, you didn't feel like you were a grown-up yet. So it was like walking into adulthood in the dark and trying to feel your way through. That's what the song was about to start with, and musing on that place there where, as a boy, you might have known everything that boys could ever know. Now, people were talking to you like you could grow a beard, and you couldn't.
And all these years later, does Dave Wakeling know what to expect going forward? Are we still those little boys and little girls from way back when?
There is a Peter Pan part of it. I think the moment that you figure it out in the morning when you're cleaning your teeth, like a eureka moment, that's the day that by lunchtime you're stricken with something that's going to take you out and take your memory with it. I don't think you're allowed to know stuff like that.
You guys spun off into General Public. What was that like for you guys?
Well, it was a bit of freedom. You could have the music just the way you want it for your vocals. You know, when you're writing with a lot of people involved, then the song can get dragged. It's lots of different ways. Even if it started off with you, once you give it, it's like giving it to a pack of dogs. And they're off. And they do all the bits they think are really clever, and then they go to the pub, and you're left with a song that's about 10 beats a minute faster than when you wrote it, and the words don't fit anymore. They go, well, just change the words then. Okay. So there's quite a bit of having to modify what your original vision was. You're writing sort of by committee, you know, or you're rehearsing by committee. You go, it's too fast for the words, and somebody goes, I like it that fast. I think it's boring at the speed you like. And they all go, yes, it's boring. You know, all right, okay. And you do. Now, when general public came along, we had a little bit more say-so on it, and it's like, well, this is the tempo I would like it at. And so you find there, I would say, the major difference is the songs are all about the right speed. There's none of them that spin off out of control. I think Click Click ended up 182 beats per minute. I don't know how anybody counts that. That's right. Like 3 beats a second. Right. But I think there's machine guns that operate slower than that.
So we've got English Beat, General Public. You're all part of that incredible genre I call sort of that 80s alternative sound, college rock here in the United States, or college alternative, yeah, synth pop. What is the staying power of that genre of music all these years later?
I think there's an optimism from a distance, whether it was the optimism of syncopated alternative pop rock in our case, mm-hmm, or the Police, or, you know, other things along that side of things, or whether it was the sheer joy of brand new sounds nobody had ever heard before on a brand new synthesizer just out this week. To start with, it was brand new, and each sound on the DX7 was a delight. Listen to that. Right. And so I think there was a sense of joy was accompanying those songs. Also, I think you'd got post-punk, so you'd got the revolution of punk. They'd blown all the buildings over. And so now, so long as you were catchy with post-punk into new wave, you could more or less do anything if you could fill a room with people dancing who liked to buy records. Record companies would support your art. And so not only did you have a very diverse set of bands coming out, the audience, the fans, were allowed to be very broad in their like of bands. It wasn't particularly tribal. You could like the Smiths and the Beat,
right,
and Depeche Mode, mm-hmm, and Echo and the Bunnymen, and there was nothing wrong with anybody. If you were to ask anybody, well, why'd you like them if you like them? You'd be like, new wave. It's like a whole new wave.
Yeah, but, and I can remember you hit the nail on the head for me. So it was 1984. It was my first time going to London. I was, I think, 14 years old. My father was teaching over there. And I remember going to record stores and sort of, because I had an ear for this music. And one of the first 45s that I brought back was Haircut 100. And I just thought that that sound was so new and so different to a 14-year-old American kid.
Yes.
We couldn't get that stuff.
About it. That was Bob Sargent as well, who produced the Beat.
Oh.
And because Simon Potts, the A&R fellow, signed Haircut 100 to Arista 2, he gave Bob Sargent a chance to produce them, and with a little bit of work. We were a small band, the Beat, and whenever we wanted anything that we didn't have in our group, we'd try and nick it off somebody else. So the trumpet solo in I Confess and the percussion playing on that song and others are the blokes from Haircut 100.
Oh, wow.
We got Bob Sargent to talk them into it.
The record industry has changed over the years, you know, whether it's for the better or for worse. In 2014, you announced that you started a pledge for a new album. Here We Go, Love. That was in 2014, and it's coming out in a few weeks. Tell us a little bit about the album and sort of the inspiration behind it.
Well, it took a minute to get the pledge fundraising thing going, but we got it started late in 2014 and got some demos started and started the process. We started with 40 songs. Some of them were finished. Some of them were halfway done. Some of them were just ideas, but really smashing ones that sounded like they could go all the way. And we went from 40 and whittled it down with some friends to 20. And then we had to get it down again, and we got it down to 13. And I think in the process, we ended up getting a nice balance of various tempos of songs and various moods and a balance between love and politics, or, you know, that sort of thing. And it's worked out very nicely. We spent quite a long time on the running order. We thought we'd end up losing a song. It was meant to be a baker's dozen, you know. You cook 13 cakes and one falls on the floor.
Right.
You've still got 12. But all 13 turned out really nicely, and we didn't have the heart split them up. People said, oh, just stick it on as an extra track, as a B-side. Or it's like, no, we're just going to put them on the record. And I'm glad we did, because we ended up making about 6 or 7 different running orders. And we got very close. The first three or four times you'd have, ooh, that sounds great, but there'd be some place where you'd go, well, that doesn't work into there, does it? That just feels sad. About running order number six, just only moving one song or two songs, all of a sudden we listened and it was like, my heavens, it's like it tells a story, isn't it? And it's not. It doesn't tell a story, but it feels like it does.
Right.
It feels like it starts you off somewhere, takes you through a variety of hills and dales and mood, and then you end up walking off into the sunset together with us whistling on a beautiful summer's evening. And even more so than the general public thing, these songs, they sound exactly the way they sounded in my head before I ever recorded any of them.
Okay.
And that's really spooky. The best place to do a gig is in your imagination, trust me.
In one of those songs that was in your imagination, calming you and warming you, was How Can You Stand There? What was the sort of inspiration for the naming of that song, and what's the song about?
It comes from a kind of my dad had on the works of Rudyard Kipling, which he used to like to recount and recite when he'd had too much to drink to remember them correctly. And then you'll be a man, my son, you know. Sort of World War II poems by Rudyard.
Oh.
And he had said something along the lines of, you know, so why stand when you can sit? Why sit when you could lie? Why lie if you could tell the price for the same truth?
Wow.
But when you could tell the truth for the same price, which I think my dad took to mean that you only needed to tell the truth if it was the same price as lying. Not that it was a principled matter. But
right.
Anyway, so that's where it first came from. My dad's interpretation of Rudyard Kipling over a couple of pints of brown ale, I think. And so it just turned into my notion of how can you stand there when all around you is a lie? And whether you call it fake news or fake outrage or fake policy, fake excuses to a working class, all of those things.
I'm sensing as I chat with you and others, current artists and from back in the day, that they're using this sort of geopolitical upheaval that's going on really as a moment, much like it was back in the 80s, inspired and to write all these like great songs.
And more realizing that we're kind of all in the same boat, whether we like it or not sometimes. At the same time, the boat's getting very full, and you only need a few people to panic and the whole thing could tip over.
Absolutely. Well said.
And we're right there, I think, and that's why I brought this record out. You know, I did it in 1980. I just thought, Dave, these people deserve it, mate. Bring a record out and save this world. Give them a chance. Give them a dance. Give them a chance to see whether they can pull this together. And we nearly did it. Now we're in trouble again. And so I've come out, brushed the cobwebs off, and all right, one more record now, and if you don't get it this time, then that's it.
And thank you, Dave, for writing this great record, Here We Go, Love. This is Chris Atwood from The Alternative. We've been chatting with Dave Wakeling from The English Beat. Dave, thank you for coming on the show tonight.
My absolute pleasure. Quite an interesting set of questions there. That's spread me a little wider than normal. I was grateful for that.
And we'll see you next week at the Sinclair in Boston.
How fantastic is that as well? A very gracious place, stylish place. Come and join us on the bus if you like.
Will do. Thank you.